History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned by now is that they don't have to go untold, as long as we don't wait too long to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then to invest enough time to listen as stories from days gone by take on new relevance in the here and now. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The veteran whose memories we'll have the privilege of exploring today spent 31 years in the Army, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. He served in World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. 98-year-old Glenn Montgomery makes his home now in Colorado Springs, Colorado, but his formative years were spent in rural Oklahoma.
I was born and raised in a little cow town called Sterling, Oklahoma. And I was born on 14th of November, 1924.
And did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I had one brother and two sisters.
And how big of a place was Sterling?
Oh, 150, 200 maybe. It all depends on time of year. Cotton pickers come and go, and so do farm workers.
So you were probably working on that farm for as long as you can remember, huh?
Yes, I was born on the farm.
And you know, most kids today don't know what a farm looks like. What were some of the things you had to do on the farm? What were your chores?
Milk cows, goats, help with the hog slaughter, milk in the morning before I went to school. Gosh, there's so many things to talk about, you can't remember them all. Those are the main thing. And I also drove tractor, plowing. My father was in the auctioneer business. Livestock, hogs, sheep, anything else that was for sale. He contracted by the farm, not individually or privately. He contracted to do the whole thing for the farmer who wanted to sell or whatever his reasoning.
And do you remember in those early years having a thought in your head, hey, someday this is who I'm going to be, or this is what I'm going to do with my life?
Well, I was busy being a farmer.
And I've interviewed a lot of World War II veterans who came from Oklahoma, but a lot of them didn't stay there. A lot of them got chased out by the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression. How did that impact your family?
As I recall, Herbert Hoover made a speech in 1928, somewhere there, about hard times. And it so happened that the Dust Bowl and the Depression were coincided together. Yes, I lived through the Dust Bowl and on a dusty day, which was practically every day. At a distance, you could see a cloud coming, which wasn't a cloud at all. It was just dirt in the air up 2,000 or 3,000 feet rolling towards the farm. And after the storm had passed, you could walk over the barbed wire fences with the dust. And you'd find livestock by how many feet they had sticking up out of the dirt. They weren't alive, of course. That is also during the Depression. It was hard, very difficult to go to a grocery store. I remember going to the store there. Eldo Himes had a grocery store. My mother would buy a pair of shoes or a shirt. Shirt was 29 cents. A pair of shoes, you could call shoes, but they were mostly, in those days, the kids called them tennis shoes. They were similar to what I got on now. That's what, I rode a pony to school every day.
You rode a pony to school every day?
Every day. Consolidated school to the eighth grade. The kids that lived, most of them, 99% of them lived on a farm. The girls parked their horses in the corral on the right side of the school, and the boys had their horses on the left side in a fenced-in area, hay. And after school, we'd all choose upside and play a game on horseback called down. I don't know where the name came from, but we chased each other and had a flag, and we'd capture the, that was another name of the game, was capture the flag. And we would capture the red flag and ride back to our goal, and they would seal it and take it back to their goal. Sometimes we fell off and sometimes we didn't.
I don't think there's any school in America playing that game today. Boy, how times have changed. And you said you rode a pony every day. Did that pony have a name?
It was a gift from my father. I was home in bed about 2:30, 3 in the morning, and heard all this noise. It was just off the kitchen. And my mother was talking to my father. I had no idea, but I was in bed. I heard all this noise coming down the hall. My mother came over and shook me and said, "Wake up, wake up, wake up. Your father is home," or some such. And he had a pony for me, all saddled and ready to go. At 2:30 in the morning, he brought that little horse. It was a paint, brown and white. Of course, I had to get up and ride the horse at 2:30 in the morning. Yeah, that was a great, great day. I rode that little horse to school. And of course, kids don't realize what they're doing. They tease the animal, and they become very uneasy to handle. They kick, they bite. So my father had to get rid of the horse because of the treatment that it was getting from the other kids. But there were other horses, riding horses. I had mules, lots of mules. My father owned a threshing machine with a two-cylinder case engine, 8-inch cylinders horizontally opposed and cranked on the side. The compression was so great on the, when cranking it, you had a petcock that you opened to the cylinder and reduce the compression. And if you didn't, it could kick and so put the pipe with a ratchet type crank and it would backfire and throw that crank across the road. Then we had a hired hand. His name was Shorty. Shorty what? Shorty who? Have no idea. But anyway, he was from one of the boroughs in New York. And we had outdoor toilets in those days. A hole in the ground with a hole in the top. We sat on it and used Cedro Book catalog to clean up. He was bit by black widow spiders on his rear end. And he was in bad shape for quite a while. That happened in 1934. Dr. Hitch was the local doctor. Didn't have a car. He had a one-horse buggy that he would call on his patients. My mother sent me down to him one day. I had an abscessed tooth. She got on the crank phone. My mother would ask him over the phone and said, "I'm sending Glenn down. He's got what appears to be an abscessed tooth. What will you need?" And he probably come. Say, "Just send me a can of peaches." That's about all he had. His walls of his office was just lined with food items that the people had gave him in exchange for. Nobody had any money. If he had any, he had it all. But I don't think he did. He was a nice guy, but his left leg was about 3 or 4 inches shorter than the other, and the sole of his shoe was about 3 inches thick. But anyway, almost any time of day, you could see him with that whip and that buggy going up Main Street, going to see a patient. And he went a long ways, all the way to Fletcher, which is 13 miles. But it was all oil country also. Sorrel, Oklahoma, Anadarko, Oklahoma, all of those places were within walking distance or riding distance.
Did you go to high school or no?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, yeah. I went to high school. Duncan, Oklahoma. We at the end of the Depression, times were so bad, my father had to sell the farm. Unfortunately, too, they were not getting along. They had a divorce. And my mother moved to Duncan and took me. I was still, there were four of us, four children. But my brother was 16 years older than I was. And then my older sister, she was about 12 years or older. Then my younger sister was about 7 years older than me. But the family split. My brother was even married by the time I was born. All that kind of stuff, I could talk all day. How we cut ice with an ice saw, put the iceberg, the saw on the lake, and put it in the ice house. which was insulated with the bales of cotton. That's where we got the ice. Harvest come around every year. My father would go from farm to farm to farm, threshing. The farm lady would have to furnish the food for the crew, and there'd be about 20, 22. My mother cooked at a cook shack and fed all 22 men every morning and night. I could go on like this, but it serves no purpose. Most of it I've forgotten.
I'm guessing that you would have still been in high school on December 7th, 1941.
Absolutely.
Do you remember that day?
It was at a Duncan. Duncan was a town of about 13,000. There was a game that they called down. One person who was IT, bend over and put his elbows on his knees, and he would become a saddle horse. We'd get our hands on his back, then the rest of the body would flow past there. And we were playing this game, and somebody said, "What's that noise? Who's that? Who's yelling?" And we heard talking about war in the Pacific. I didn't know who it was because the kids that I played with were right there. And we found out one of the kids came by, and he still had papers in a white tarpaulin type of a bag. And we were curious and asked him about. He said that they were selling papers in the streets because of the bombing. And we asked him, "What bombing?" He said he didn't know. He thought it was somewhere in some ocean. And he said he didn't mention Japan, but he said somebody bombed somebody. And, of course, there was the paper, and some of us could read. And there was Pearl Harbor. We said, "Where's Pearl Harbor?" And the boy said he didn't know, but it was in an ocean someplace. And I said, "I never heard of Pearl Harbor, and I had no idea where it was." So that was our beginning. Well, myself and Wayne King and David and Joseph Coomer went to the, in those days, the recruiting office of the services was in the post office. All it consisted of was a desk and a chair. So we went down to the Brave Us to show how brave we were. We went down there, and there was quite a gathering of adults. Or possibly 200 or 300 people. This recruiting sergeant, I assume he's recruiting, because he wore an armband that said recruits. And we asked him what was going on. He explained it to us. And why are you kids here? How come you're not in school? And we're down here to join up. He told us, he said, "If you have any idea of joining the service for us right now, you go home and get me a piece of paper and bring it back. It says this, and signed by your parents, and I'll consider it, and I'll talk to you." Well, that was the end of that. He put the quietus on. Well, but Wayne King and I kept at it. We're both Navy men. Why, I haven't the faintest idea. Well, I guess it was because of the ship, because Oklahoma's dry as a bone. And, well, I was finally drafted and out of high school. Took a bus ride up to Oklahoma City where the physical examination place was. The bus load was kids about my age. Maybe some of them were. I remember one adult who was a brother of one of my friends. His name was Ziegler. He was probably 40 years old, and he was on the school bus with us going to Oklahoma City. Anyway, we went through, got a physical examination, loaded back on the bus, and shipped us to Fort Sill. Fort Sill is near Lawton, about 100 miles southwest of Oklahoma City. I was put up in some barracks. They issued us uniforms. Some fit, and most didn't. And I got somebody shook me sometime during the morning hours, said, "Get up, report to the mess hall, you're on KP. Well, I was on KP for 13 days, washing potatoes, a 100-pound sack at a time. And luckily, they had a potato peeler. Put the 100 pounds in there, and whoopoo, potato mash. Yeah, and then we were shipped out, woke up in the morning also. They had a marshaling yard there, Fort Sill. We were loaded on passenger trains and headed south of Duncan, as Comanche, and then Kiowa, Waurika, all of those Indian names. Of course, the rumors flew in every direction. Well, if we leave it up to a bunch of draftees, kids, the rumors fly and fly fast. one of the jokes was that when we get someplace, Fort Smith, Arkansas, we were going the opposite direction from Fort Smith, Arkansas. The joke was, if you're drafted and if you don't go to Smith, you go to Fort Bliss. Well, we wound up in Fort Bliss on the train. Still didn't know where we were. The joke was that when they give you the physical at Fort Bliss, they shoot you in the left testicle with a needle, and it stunts your growth. The rumors, they make them up. I mean, boy, there's it's no telling. Well, about dusk on the third day of being parked in Fort Bliss, they hooked us up with another train headed for Needles, Arizona, Southern California, all up the coast. Finally got to Camp Adair, Oregon. Nobody knew where it was, what it was, when it was. It's not there now. It was released and given back to the owners. But anyway, that's where I took basic training right then. I'd been in the Army about a week or two.
What was basic training like? Was it a challenge? Was it an adjustment for a farm kid from Oklahoma?
Something every minute. Rifle training, just aiming alone took a couple of days to teach them how to aim the rifle, how to dismantle it. M1 rifles, what they were. We were the first drafted troops to be issued the M1. The rest of them were 03 A3s. But anyway, we went through basic training there. Once in a while, maybe a day or two, we would go to the theater and they ran the propaganda movies. One was a film I'll never forget. The director of the film was out of Hollywood. Why We Fight series. They had built these wartime theaters and it was holding a lot of people.
Did it work? Did the propaganda rub off on you? Did it convince you of the mindset they wanted you to have?
It taught me things I didn't know existed. I didn't even know what Hollywood is. Because we had a movie theater in Sterling that was in the back of the beer hall. All silent movies. There were just wood benches, and there was a wood-burning stove. People would crowd around the stove, and as they got warmer, they'd push away. And, of course, the piano would play. If it was a horse riding a horse, get up on the telephone or on the piano. Or if it was a drama scene, it would be the la, 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 you know. And the fare to get into the movie was 7 cents for kids. I remember some of the names of the people that played the piano. Mrs. Richardson, the only grocery store. And then there was others, I can't remember their names.
You were talking about Camp Adair, and you were the first troops issued the M1. I've heard a lot of guys talk about M1 thumb, and if you guys were the guinea pigs with this new rifle.
I don't remember that, but I'd heard it before.
Never happened to you?
No, I can explain how it works, though. The bolt on a long rod, the gases in the tube would push the bolt open, and if it was the last round, it would stay open. And it was right where your thumb would stay. When you saluted with the gun, with the M1, you had to hold it cross body position, and your thumb was right there. And you closed the bolt, you push back on it a little bit, and pull, and the thing slammed forward, and that thumb is the one that was in the way. I never had one, but I know a lot of guys that did.
He never experienced M1 thumb, but he did receive a Purple Heart. We'll explore that and more with 98-year-old Glenn Montgomery when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.